Welcome to this episode of Religion and American Life, a podcast of the Blasey Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. I am Mark Massa, the director of the Blasey Center, and today's podcast host. This podcast is the newest initiative in the Blasey Center's commitment to connecting a community of scholars, policymakers, media, and religious leaders in conversation and scholarly reflection around issues at the intersection of religion and American public life. On September 16th of this year, 22-year-old Mahsa Amini died in a hospital after having been taken into custody by the Guidance Patrol, usually referred to as Iran's morality police. She was allegedly in violation of the government standards regarding her wearing of the hijab. While the government maintains she died of a heart attack, eyewitnesses allege that she died as a result of being severely beaten. Her death sparked widespread protests in the country. And just this month, and seemingly in response to these protests and the global outrage following Amini's death, it appeared that the morality police were being dissolved. But questions remain. To dig into these issues, that is the morality police, the protests in Iran, and women protesting within Islam more generally, we are joined by BC professors Natana DeLongbas and Kristen Peterson. Natana is associate professor in the Department of Theology at Boston College, past president of the American Council for the Study of Islamic Societies. She is an expert on, among many other things, Islam and Christianity, women and gender, and Islamic law. Among her many publications are Sharia, What Everyone Needs to Know, and Islam, A Living Faith. Kristen Peterson is an assistant professor in the Department of Communications at Boston College, whose research focuses on religious expression in digital media, specifically examining how young people engage with online media sites, images, videos, and creative projects as spaces to develop meaning and for feminist activism. Many of these ideas are explored in her most recent book, On Woolly Souls, The Digital Activism of Muslim and Christian Feminists. Natana and Kristen, welcome.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Natana, while there have been ongoing protests in Iran since July of 2021, to most casual newspaper readers, it seems that the protests in Iran emerged after the death of Mahsa Amini, who had been arrested for wearing an improper hijab by the Guidance Patrol or morality police. Can you situate this event in the arc of the protests that have been occurring in Iran?
So in order to really situate these, we need to look at well over 20 years worth of protests. There's a long and strong history of engaging in protests in Iran. And many analysts and observers would make the argument that these protests have built upon each other. And if we go back to 1999, which marked the most widespread protests in Iran following the Islamic Revolution, what we found was that this was really the first generation that had been raised under the Islamic Republic that was becoming politically engaged. And they were engaged with respect to the question of government reform. What they were looking for was a reform of the government that would replace the Islamic Republic with a government that really was more interested in upholding the ideals of secular democracy. There were 50,000 people who protested in Iran, thousands more in other cities. These protests were put down by the police and military forces. And the protests essentially subsided for about 10 years. In 2009, we see another surfacing of protest, again, with this question of reform. And the protests always begin peacefully, nonviolently, but become radicalized by the introduction of police and military forces that are designed to put them down. And so here we found the reformists in opposition to what we might call the more hardline conservative clerical regime over what were widely perceived to be fraudulent election results. And so we had months of mass protests and violence that resulted in between 500,000 and 3 million people protesting in the streets. It was the largest demonstration in the Islamic Republic's history. And I mention that because up until 2009, the focus was on the hope for reform of the government that existed. After 2009, it was widely perceived that the possibility of reform had ended. And that's when we really move into much more widespread kinds of protests that ultimately, instead of calling for death to America, as we heard during the Islamic Revolution in 1979, now we hear death to the dictator and death to the regime. Beginning in 2017, 2018, we have many protests that begin on the basis of political opposition, but also introducing economic issues into the picture. By 2019, there were what were called the Bloody November protests that were sparked by a serious increase in fuel prices. And in that particular series of protests, the government initiated a really harsh crackdown. They were shooting at protesters from rooftops. They were shooting at protesters from helicopters. They had the Basiji who were there mowing protesters down with machine guns. Over 1,500 people were killed in these protests. The government eventually crushed them for a time, but there have been periodic protests since then over water shortages and rising prices in wheat. And my point here is that in as much as the government crackdowns have tried to put the lid back on the tinderbox of serious social unrest, it hasn't worked. The protests continue to erupt. And so this incident with Mahsa Amini and the hijab was not a one-shot deal. This was something that had been building for a long time, and this really was the spark that just blew the lid off of this particular tinderbox. And it's no longer about hijabs and how women are dressing. This has really turned into a mass movement that is calling for the overthrow of the regime. And I think the fact that even though we see people being killed, being detained, being incarcerated, being tortured, even being executed in recent days, they still come out and protest. And that says to me that the issues are not going away, that things have reached a point where some kind of major change and response is needed.
Certain Islamic groups are perceived by outsiders as being oppressive to women. These protests seem to indicate that women are no longer considering themselves subordinate to men in Iran. Is this part of a larger trend of women making their voices heard within Islam?
Yeah, so I think for Muslim women, generally, you have two pressures that are often at play that you have to talk about. So one is you have this assumption from the West that Islam is somehow inherently oppressive, Muslim men are somehow inherently irrational and violent. So you have that, kind of anti-Islam rhetoric, and the solution is often, oh, remove the headscarf, save the women, right? But then you also have the pressure within Islam to portray the religion in a positive light, because in the midst of all this anti-Islam rhetoric, there's a need to position women as not being victimized, right? And to kind of show like, okay, that it's not the religion that's the problem. But what I think I see happening here as part of a larger trend of women and other sexual minorities, gender minorities, bringing issues up that are really problematic within these communities and looking at how there's a lot of gender-based violence, there's a lot of misogyny that's happening within these spaces, right? And so we're seeing, the way that Islam has been weaponized, how these tools, symbols like the hijab have become sort of tools of control. And this isn't really representative of Islam, but more, using this to promote patriarchal regimes, right? And so I also see the way that the media, for the most part, Western media has been portraying this is pretty clearly that it's not about the headscarf, but it's about these larger issues, right? And it's not so simple as just removing the headscarf, leaving Islam, that you will somehow be, saved in that way. But I do think you see these really moving images of women who are breaking free of a lot of these restrictions, celebrating who they are. You see a lot of images of women in various attire, dancing, listening to music, wearing makeup, the images of them cutting their hair. So you do see these forms of expression. But as Natana said, these protests are about a lot more than just wearing the headscarf. They're about political oppression, lack of economic opportunity. And really, I see this as a youthful protest, that the youth don't see the future. They're very depressed. They don't want to stay in this country. They don't see anything for them in this country. And so it's really, I think, more of a movement in that direction. But definitely I would see this as a trend, that we can see a larger trend of Muslim women talking about issues of abuse, misogyny. You have a movement like Mosque Me Too, which is talking about sexual abuse that happens within Islamic holy sites. You have lots of projects I'm familiar with ones more in the English speaking world that are looking at domestic violence in Muslim homes, looking at sexual abuse that happens, looking at sexual harassment within Muslim communities. So there are projects that are happening and people talking about these issues. And like I said, it's working against this kind of pressure that we don't want to portray the religion in a negative light. We don't want to feed the anti-Islamic rhetoric, but more people saying we need to talk about these things, we need to address these problems.
So is your sense then that the women themselves doing the protests want to separate Islam as a religion from the way it's expressed in the culture of the country itself?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that there's a lot of people who would like to be secular, who aren't really interested in religion, but that doesn't mean that there aren't people who would like to still remain part of the faith and the traditions, but see it in a different way, right? Have a more of a feminist interpretation of it. And so I think there's room for all of those things within this movement. Yeah.
If I might add to that, I think one of the things that we're seeing with the women protesters is an attempt to separate religion from this particular government. And one of the ways that they're doing that is by taking control back over some of these symbols. So in as much as the government is saying, well, you have to wear a hijab in this particular way, the fact that we have women removing these hijabs and burning them publicly makes their own statement about taking control over their own appearance, similarly with cutting their own hair as opposed to having it shaved off in prison. And even some of the positioning of the images, when you see the government that is intentionally targeting women's faces, breasts, and genitalia with their shooting, proclaiming this sort of government complete autonomy over women's bodies, the fact that women continue to present their bodies in public places to engage in these protests, I think sends their own message about claiming their autonomy and their voices, even within the prisons. There was a letter that was just released in the last couple of days by 18 women who've been in prison and even prison for quite some time. And they are staging a sit-in strike in the prison. You know, you can throw us in jail, but we are not going to stop protesting and expressing our voices and claiming our rights. So I really see them positioning themselves that rather than being the victims of this government, they are the voices that are speaking out against it. And they're very creative in the way that they're doing this. It's really quite powerful.
Kristen, are there common platforms being used to mobilize these protests by women?
So I think what's interesting in this movement is, unlike, you know, we talk a lot about the Arab Spring and the protests in Turkey, and in those cases, I think there was a coordination that would be happening on platforms where people would say, like, let's meet at this place or don't go to this area because there's police there and planning the various protests. I think in this case, we're seeing a lot of different things going on. So, you know, you have the limitations in terms of what the government is allowing people to do. So sometimes people aren't even able to access these platforms. But I think, you know, that they're finding ways around that, and we can talk more about that. But I think the main thing is it's to share these images, share the videos of what's happening. And that can be done for different reasons. Like, first of all, it could be done for solidarity, right, to gain people in the West showing solidarity, but also people there to come out and support the protests. I think it's a really important evidence, right, of what's happening and what's going on that can be shown to people outside as well. And then I think there is some sort of coordination that's going on, but there's a lot of different platforms that are being used. So, you know, what's interesting is, I didn't realize this at first, but in previous protests, the government had blocked Facebook, Twitter, WhatsApp, some of these platforms, but allowed Instagram because there was an idea that that was a platform that could be used for promoting the regime. So a lot of clerics have Instagram pages. And also there's a lot of like influencers, you know, quote unquote, social media influencers that the regime is trying to like, you know, use for propaganda purposes. And they also saw it as like a good economic space that they could promote, you know, people could buy and sell products and things like that. So they allowed that up until recently. I think they blocked that within the last few weeks or so. And so it didn't have as much censorship. So there's a lot of stuff happening mostly on Instagram. So on Instagram, you see a lot of, you know, images, videos, a lot of infographics. You know, even right now, if you go, you see a lot of infographics about what's happening with the people who are imprisoned, what's going on with them, people who've been executed. So you have accounts like Middle East Matters, which is a pretty popular one, and a few other ones within Iran. And also they're documenting videos of funerals, videos of families who are mourning, videos of parents, relatives, tribute videos to people. So you've seen a lot of that on Instagram. That's also on Twitter as well. I think Twitter allows for people to circulate more to like the Western audience, to Western news media. You're seeing similar things, a lot of sharing of information. And then we can't really access this, but I'm sure they're using, you know, in messaging apps, WhatsApp, Telegram, to circulate things, information, memes, things like that. So there isn't really, like I said, one platform, but it's kind of, and I think this is sort of true across the board with a lot of social activism, is it's more like, we have this information, we want to get it out there. How can we do that? So let's use whatever platform's available, whatever platform's not being blocked, whatever place is going to get information out there to more people. Obviously, TikTok is another platform where people have been sharing, you know, videos of protests, but also kind of these personal testimonial videos or videos of cutting their hair. So you're seeing a lot of things like that as well. Another thing, and this speaks to what Natanya was talking about, is the creativity of some of this work. You know, you see this beautiful artwork created, you know, kind of, you know, iconic images of the protesters. Also protest music. There's been several rappers who've been imprisoned for their music. I just saw today this like very interesting like movie posters, where it's like an image of a bunch of clerics and it says like No Country for Old Men. So it's kind of like a bit of this tongue in cheek. There's a lot of humor to some of this stuff too, especially in regards to the clerics. There's a lot of kind of making fun, these kind of deep fake videos, skateboarding videos, dancing videos, things like that. So there's a lot of things happening, but I wouldn't say a lot is necessarily coordinating protests, but more being used to show solidarity, being used to share, to document what's going on, to honor the people who've been imprisoned, to work to get them released as well. Yeah.
Natana, how has or how is the Iranian government cracking down on those platforms?
They've tried to shut down a number of things. They routinely shut down the internet to try to prevent information from getting out. There had been a question as to whether they were going to shut down cell phone networks, but apparently they use the GPS tracking devices in the phones to try to track protesters down. So they have to make decisions about how much they want to block from themselves as well as other people. And I think to go back to that question of creativity and the different kinds of things that are being posted, every time the government tries to take control of something, people are finding other ways around it. The government, for example, has tried to block funeral processions as much as possible. And I think in the process, they end up showing themselves to be very inhumane and are really raising questions about just exactly what kind of religion this government is promoting. If you are disrupting funeral processions, which is putting the deceased to rest, even to the point of confiscating the body of the second young woman who died in police custody, Nika Shakarami, her body was not given back to her family. The government decided to take it and bury it themselves because they were trying to block this idea of funeral processions because they didn't want people gathering for that. People gather anyway. And because there's this tradition 40 days after a person dies of going back and rejoining with the family, there's this ongoing sense of mourning and processions. Every time somebody else is killed, you've just started another 40-day cycle. And so the government is actually shooting itself in the foot by doing this, because instead of the protests dying out, they just keep ramping up and you have more and more people joining in this. And I think speaking to what Kristen was saying, there's also been this desire to personalize very much people, not so much as regime victims, but as persons and voices of courage. That if you look at the surrounding circumstances and the fact that people have, you know, dared to protest or to express their support for the protesters, even at the risk of their own lives when they could easily be looking toward other things. These are young people in their 20s for the most part. I think that sends its own kind of message and raises real questions then about the future of the country. If you are literally killing the future of your country, what kind of future is going to be left for it? So I think the government at some point is going to have to start asking itself some very difficult questions.
There seems to be a bit of confusion with regard to the morality police. Have they actually been dissolved, or has their enforcement changed as a result of the protests?
So from what I am reading, it was the Attorney General, Mohamed Jafar Montazeri, who announced the suspension of the morality police. So not quite the same as dissolving it. But he made it very clear at the same time that the judiciary was going to continue to monitor public conduct. There's been some question as to whether the Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei has actually weighed in on this particular question or not. Initially, the protesters were looking at at least the removal or suspension of the morality police from the scene as a minor sort of victory, but they made it very clear that this was not going to be the end of the protest. Nothing less than regime change was going to be acceptable at this point. So even if the government gives a little bit, it is not going to be enough to resolve the many issues that have been burgeoning beneath the surface for the last really 30 years.
Yeah, it seems to be a PR campaign, and it seemed at the first, you know, at first that a lot of the Western media kind of jumped on it and reported about it as if it was a significant change. But I don't think it's a significant change.
So do you think that the cutting back or the pulling back on the morality police, is it primarily in response to the internal protests, or is it primarily in response to the way the West of the world, perhaps even the rest of the Islamic world, perceives what's going on is somehow problematic from an explicitly Islamic point of view?
I think it's the latter, because you see this idea of the morality police were the ones that were responsible for this murder. And it's almost like, well, if we get rid of that idea of morality police, then we will be able to progress, and that's the problem, which obviously that's not the problem. There's so many other issues at play here. So yeah, I think it kind of, in some ways, the Western media sort of took the bait and went forward with that, but I don't think that's what was going on.
Kristen, how has what's been going on, what's happening in Iran, appeared in social media platforms from Muslim women or organizations in the West? And are the messages supportive of those protests?
Yeah, I think overall the message is extremely supportive. I think from one end of the spectrum, you'd have something like more of a progressive Western secular media space. You know, I saw quite a lot of articles in like women's magazines about the protests and like Cosmo and The Cut and Vogue and things like that, right? Talking about it. And sometimes that might be falling more into the Western saving the women. But for the most part, I think it's actually been pretty well done in terms of the coverage. And then you have obviously Muslim Americans, Western Muslims, obviously interested in this, talking about it, writing about it. But then what I think is the most admirable work that's being done is among the diaspora, the Iranian diaspora, which is a very strong, powerful group. And I think they're really responsible for doing a lot of really, really important work to translate what's happening, literally to translate, but to explain what's going on for a Western audience. And they're doing really tireless work to advocate to get information out there about what's going on. And they're kind of, in some ways, serving as the internet source for the people on the ground. When the internet is blocked, they're getting information out there, and they're even, you know, serving as, you know, housing information and helping Iranians to access, you know, the internet and things like that. So, and they're also doing a lot of investigative work to document, like, the people who've died, people who've been disappeared, people who've been imprisoned. So they're really doing a lot of very significant work, and also doing really important work to advocate, you know, on these social media platforms, because social media in the last, you know, really since 2020 in the summer, like Instagram, TikTok, these platforms have become political spaces where people are talking about social issues, and in particular, progressive issues. And this is one of the issues that is coming up a lot within social media spaces. I was just looking at videos from one woman, Alika LeBron, and she is very active on TikTok. And she has one video that has millions of views that is talking about this idea of needing to make the people who are imprisoned, what she calls famous. Basically, this idea, this campaign, it's called like Say Their Names to Save Their Names, so this or to save their lives, right? So this idea that you need to publicize the names of these people and what's happening to them. And I think the idea is that she believes that the government will not execute them, will free them, because if these names are made public and there's pressure, that they will do something about it, because the idea is that, well, nobody knows who they are, right? And so we can just forget about them. So yeah, I would say it's, you know, obviously you see reporting, very positive coverage, but I think that this advocacy work on behalf of the diaspora is to really get this information out there to these progressive groups is really important.
Natana, is this the beginning, just the beginning of more crackdowns in response to this? Or do you think it's going in the opposite direction in terms of the government's fear of what's happening and the perception of both the Islamic world and of the West that this is deeply problematic? So do you see other crackdowns coming down the line here?
It seems that the regime is really trying to send a strong message right now with the rapid pace at which death sentences are being passed down and executions are being carried out. And that is certainly very concerning. It's a pretty standard authoritarian tactic that you try to scare the people back into their homes and scare them into behaving properly. But if we look at the time frame that this is already stretched out over, September through December, I think the cat's out of the bag, that this is not going to be, even in the past when there were massive protests, the government was still able to put them away within a few days. And this is not going away. It is continuing. So I think we are probably going to continue to see more of the same, hopefully not executions, and death sentences being handed down not only to young adults, but also to children under the age of 18. There have been 3 death sentences handed down in the past week to children, which is very concerning. But I think Crispin's pointing to something that is really important about, you know, naming the names to save the lives. And there was a book that literally just came out this week by Narges Mohammadi called White Torture, Interviews with Iranian Women Prisoners, that was put together before these 2022 protests began, but documents interviews with many women, including herself, who've been imprisoned on and off since 2009 for some of the same kinds of issues that we've been talking about today. And so that's another way of upholding these voices and keeping these stories in the news so that people are aware that this hasn't just gone away, especially now that the World Cup is over. It may be easy to forget about certain parts of the world that aren't necessarily in the news on a daily basis, but this deserves global attention.
Just in terms of Iran's past history, how unique are these crackdowns compared to how the government reacted to religious non-observance or religious irregularities in the past? Is this a dramatically new change in how the government responds to these kinds of protests?
I think the fact of violent response to them is nothing new. I think what's different this time around is that the protesters are not going home. That despite the levels of violence that are being enacted against them, and especially against women and children as young as 10 have been killed in these protests, that they are not going home, which says something about either a degree of desperation, or I would like to believe, hopefully, a degree of courage, that these people want to take control of the future of their country and to be able to envisage a life for themselves and their families that goes beyond thinking about religion in terms of whether one's wearing a hijab or how long a person's beard is, to thinking about what it means to live as human beings and to live as communities and to be part of the world of the 21st century and to be able to share their creative and artistic gifts with the world.
I want to thank Natana and Kristen for a really interesting and insightful conversation this afternoon. I learned a great deal, and I'm sure our listeners will learn a great deal as well. So thank you both very much.
Thank you for listening to Religion and American Life, a podcast by the Boise Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. For more information on the work of the Boise Center, the Center's schedule of events, or to listen to other episodes of this podcast, please visit our website at bc.edu/Boise.